Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
It's time for Microbrew, Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the weekly podcast. On the other line is Kurt Hoag, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And real quick, after my conversation with Kurt, I've got a conversation with Jason Gerwin. He is with TheStreamable.com. I've talked to him a couple times and written some things at JSOnline.com, really looking at the Brewers' availability on TV, specifically kind of how Bally Sports Wisconsin works, how you really can only get them if you get the games if you are on satellite or with a cable company, Spectrum in Milwaukee, if that's where you live. And I asked him about sort of the landscape and if we expect that to change anytime soon. I know there's been some frustration when we ran our story about the dwindling Brewers attendance. A lot of people brought up that they just didn't have a connection with the team anymore because they no longer watch them on TV. So you can check out my conversation with him at the end, just talking about some of the factors in play there. Kurt, I think it's time that we start writing the obituary for the 2022 Milwaukee Brewers. Now, everything we say is going to have this caveat. They are 2.5 games out. Thankfully, the Phillies didn't win much this weekend either. The Padres, as we record this, look like they're on their way to another loss against the Dodgers. They obviously have a lot of Dodgers on their schedule. They're 3 games ahead of the Brewers right now. The Brewers are absolutely still in reach of a playoff spot. There are 3 weeks of baseball left, 3-plus weeks of baseball left. It's not over, but this team is not a playoff team. And if they make the playoffs, it's because they did stuff in the last few weeks of September that we just have not seen for way too long. Since the end of May to the beginning of June, this team is well below 500. They don't have any one thing, any one aspect that they're particularly good at. Now, and we'll talk about the starting pitching kind of falling off to the point that they're just very average, and pretty much everything else is just pretty average on this team. It's really getting harder and harder to envision any sort of playoff run from this team. And this week certainly proves that case. They take 2 of 3 from the Pirates. It was not a particularly glorious looking series. I think both Pirates wins were a little arduous. We could talk about that. I mean, the second one wasn't, but the Pirates gave it to them. And then they lose 3 of 4 in Arizona against a below 500 team. Really feels like we got to start thinking about what went wrong in 2022, even though the playoffs are still on the table. So Kurt, I'm just going to, like I start a lot of these, just kind of start off the top and tell me where your head is at with them. Everyone knows they're still capable of going to the playoffs mathematically. I just have nothing else to say that suggests that they can. They just don't look like a team that can. Give me your progress report, your thoughts.
Well, it seems like they've talked countless times about how, you know, they need to turn the page. I don't know how many pages are left in this thing. Like, how big is this book? Because you've turned the page, you tried to turn the page from all these tough losses for 3.5 months now, and nothing has come of it. You have gone from the hottest 50-game start in franchise history to needing to play a ridiculously good brand of baseball for the last 4 months, and that's something we haven't seen in since that 50 game start. So it's been a down spiral. It's been pretty bad. I don't necessarily think good teams, you know, have a record that's, what, let's think quick math, 6 games under 500 over a span of three plus months. That's just generally not something that teams that are going to go far do. Like you said, there's the caveat that they're not eliminated yet. They're only 2.5 games back. It seems like a big gulf, but realistically, that's not very much. I mean, that's, yeah, that can be erased in a weekend. But the problem is, to do that, you would have to sweep a team. And what indication have the Brewers given you, JR, since mid-May that, you know, they're going to be able to do that?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And this week is such a perfect example of that. When you have, they won on Monday on a walk-off on a game that Keston Hira does get the walk-off home run. So they win that one kind of by the skin of their teeth. They win a 6-1 game on what was that, Wednesday, against the Pirates. The Pirates played such horrible defense and walked in runs. And I mean, there were actually relaxing innings at the end of that game, which I don't know. By my estimation, there were four total relaxing innings in which the Brewers were winning during the month of August. That was just a crazy roller coaster ride in which the Brewers are close in a lot of these games. They just, when the offense is clicking, the pitching is not. When the pitching is clicking, the offense is not. It just seems like that's time and time again, you find them in close games that they either should lose or they have to fight by the skin of their teeth to survive. That was the case in the only game in the Diamondback series that they won, where they needed a ninth inning homer by Rowdy Tellez, who now has three of them in the past month, where he ties the game in the ninth. Two of those games the Brewers have gone on to win in extras. That included Saturday nights, and you know, with the Phillies and Padres losing that same night, that was a really productive night for them. And then on Sunday again, Sunday really isn't that big a deal. I mean, Zach Gallen is the hottest pitcher in baseball. He's got a scoreless streak that surpasses the Teddy Higuera scoreless streak from 1987 that Brewers fans remember so fondly. I mean, he's absolutely on one. The Brewers just, you know, weren't able to hit him, and then they gave up a couple runs with Jason Alexander, their weakest starting pitcher. So, like, that's an understandable loss. You have to do better than one run walked in a 2-1 loss on Friday night. You have to do better than losing to them as well on Thursday night. This is not a good baseball team, and yet they lost 3 of 4. And the Brewers, like you said, they're not sweeping anybody. They absolutely have to. They have to win 5-6 in a row to really sort of get their footing under them. They don't have any tiebreakers, and they're not going to get a playoff spot unless they absolutely rally and show something that they just haven't. They have not shown that since the month of May. One of the more discouraging things I would say this week comes in two of the wins, oddly enough. Corbin Burnes, the starting pitcher, who obviously won the Cy Young last year. He's one of the few guys on this team that you would point to as a true star on this team. Lately, he's just a guy, and that's maybe one of the more surprising developments. I mean, he's really struggling to get through six innings. He hasn't gotten outs in the seventh inning for any of his last four starts, but it isn't even just recently. I mean, overall, I would say he's kind of, you know, really since I would say July, has just been okay. Now, okay is still very good at times. I would say his overall numbers are still really quite good, actually, if you look at the season as a whole. But I don't know if what we're looking at is regression. I don't know if what we're looking at is just teams catching up to him, you know, whatever you want to call it. But it's definitely a little alarming seeing kind of your stud fall off a little bit. 5 earned runs in his last outing, or his Saturday outing, 5 earned runs against Pittsburgh the game before that. 4 earned runs, 3 earned runs. I mean, this is just more than what we're used to. We're holding to a very high standard. But how worried should people be that Corbin Burnes has been just unable to find it over the last, you know, here and there over the last couple months?
I'm not sure how worried you should be long-term, but, I mean, really the Brewers' best hope this year was, or it still is this year, is, you know, this pitching, you know, being able to ride that. And it's been a while since we've seen Corbin Burnes kind of look like the version of himself that we're used to seeing. And part of that, I think it's a confluence of things. You know, there's some of it is the league is probably catching up to him a degree in terms of, you know, what they're expecting him to do and getting used to seeing him a little more. And so he might need to switch some things up. I still think there's from time to time he tries to get too perfect, and you know, he's burning himself in some of these instances by letting guys back into counts, having a tough time putting guys away by just trying to be too perfect by executing pitches. Really, though, it's kind of emblematic of a larger issue that the Brewers have. And that's, like you mentioned earlier, the starting pitching is pretty much kind of drifting back towards being average right now. They've gotten some good starts recently from Freddy Peralta. Brandon Woodruff's been pretty good overall, and obviously Burnes has had a good year as well. But it's not what you expected from the group as a whole coming into the year. And I think it's you kind of look at what the Brewers were banking on this year coming into the year. They did almost nothing to upgrade this roster, to bolster the offense. Hunter Renfro trade was a good one, but that's about it. So they were kind of relying on elite pitching to carry them through, elite run prevention to, you know, get them to the playoffs, basically. And it seems kind of like they never, you know, it was never a question that they wouldn't make the playoffs with their roster and their pitching. And that might have been a bit of a misassumption, because they've come back to earth in a big way. Injuries have played a big role in that as well. But you just, I mean, it, last year's performance was really, really hard to sustain from pretty much everyone in that rotation, and they've all taken a step back this year.
Yeah, 95-win team last year with an extra playoff spot available this year, with a division in which three teams are basically not trying. It's just really hard to figure out the calculus to not have that Brewers team be a playoff team. And again, like, we could see baseball's crazy, and even the worst teams go on runs, and the Brewers are not one of the worst teams. They could go on a run here and prove us all wrong. But again, they would be showing us something that they haven't shown us. And as we talk about starting pitching, it leads me into discussing long-term extensions. I mean, I think it's fair to start thinking about what's beyond this season. And maybe one of the more discouraging things about this season is that I don't know if we've seen anything new that the Brewers can take into 2023 that's particularly encouraging, other than maybe what's happening in the minor leagues. You've got some really interesting prospects. Jackson Chourio, of course, is at the top of that list, but Sal Frelick as well. There's some guys that I'm interested to see down the line. But nobody jumps out at you as really like taking a huge step forward. Everybody, I think, maybe Devin Williams took a, you know, not a step forward, but sustaining his level of success is something that you can be excited about. But what's new to the team that you didn't have in 2021 that you're saying to yourself, wow, like next year they might really be able to work with this or take this step forward? If anything, I think next year's roster is a million question marks. Like, I don't know who's even going to be here. You know, you saw a step back majorly from Luis Urias. The catchers weren't really able. I mean, they've had flashes. Obviously, Victor Caratini was really good in the first half of the season, but he's really, really struggled. You know, Christian Yelich did not quite rediscover it. He changed his game a little bit, which was helpful, but still, I don't know if Hunter Renfroe is going to be here next year. Hunter Renfroe is as good an offensive player as they have, for sure. I would imagine they want to keep him, but maybe that's an opportunity to upgrade elsewhere. Colton Wong took a step back, especially defensively, not as much offensively, but I don't know what to be excited about. And as we discuss long-term extensions for these starting pitchers, particularly Corbin Burnes and Brandon Woodruff, I don't know what they're going to do here. Like, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of traction there. I don't really have a full picture of what the players want, what the team wants. I could see the team not doing that, being a little gun-shy after the Christian Yelich extension seems to have gone kind of wrong on them. And, you know, like, you watch these pitchers lately, it's like, are you sure you want to commit, you know, gajillions of dollars to these two guys? Like, I think you probably still do, but man, it's not as obvious to me as it was at the beginning of the season that, of course, you want to extend those two pitchers. Do you have any concept of where that might stand, or any thoughts on whether or not, you know, what the team might be thinking, what the players might be thinking at this stage?
We're talking about extensions here, right? There's a buffet of items that I could have gone with there. We're talking, yes, extensions now.
Yes. Sorry. I drove around the parking lot a little bit and now I'm parked. I want to talk about whether or not you're going to see these guys long term.
In a way, I mean, the issue that keeps coming up when you talk to people about a possible extension for Woodruff or Burnes is just in terms, especially with Burnes, is the market rate that, you know, he's close enough to free agency where you're not going to be able to really sneak through much of a discount. And also, you know, you figure he's going to want a contract that is very similar to what he could get on the open market. Now, with a little bit of a dip back in his performance this year, he hasn't sustained quite what he did last year, whether it's, you know, the run production or kind of the under the surface stats too, that might open an opportunity to maybe not have to pay him quite through the roof. It would still cost quite a bit, but I mean, if the Brewers look at sustaining this window, that's a difficult decision to make. I mean, it just with the way that they operate, in my mind, you know, it's you pay Corbin Burnes, you pay Brandon Woodruff, one of the two or both of them, to kind of hopefully extend your window there. But like you mentioned, they might be a bit hesitant with the Yelich deal and kind of just generally how they operate, are not quick to just dole out lots of money, and they like having flexibility. And you can weigh the pros and cons of how they go about that, but that's just the reality of the situation. So I don't know if it's going to happen with either of them. In my mind, you think Brandon Woodruff maybe would cost a little less. He's also a little bit older, so it's to be seen. I think this winter is a big time for those discussions with both having 2 years left. But even if they don't sign, you still got 2 years left. And kind of like you were getting at, there's a lot of questions on the player development side.
Yeah, let me double down back on that. What does this team look like next year? And again, I know we're putting a little cart before the horse, but how many of these people are back? Like, I don't know, have an answer to that.
Yeah, it's this offseason could go in one of two ways. You know, they've kind of hung their hat on a generally conservative approach and banking on what they think they can get from the current roster and not really adding too much to that, and, you know, kind of just having this balanced offense that, you know, theoretically over the course of the year will be fine. And I'm not sure if that's quite going to work. You know, no chips were pushed in at any point, not even saying you have to go all the way in, but no chips were really pushed in ever. But they've also got these outfielders that can, you know, probably combine to man one or two spots out there. If you include Tyrone Taylor with all those prospects, and, you know, once again, probably be fine. You've got a couple holes, you know, third base might still be a hole. I don't know what their thoughts are on Luis Urias going forward, because developmentally he has not taken the step forward that, you know, they wanted him to this year. And you can kind of say that, you know, just about the player development at the big league level across the board, aside from Kesson Hira. Kesson Hira is another question. What do you do with that man? How sustainable do you think his performance is? Is Rowdy Tellez the guy at first? I would think so. They need a catcher. So the roster could look very similar next year. I mean, pretty much most, if not all, these guys are under team control next year. But there's a few holes, and there's some room for some turnover as well and some money off the books.
Yeah, and like you said, with the outfield, yeah, that's where all the talent is filtering up when it comes to offensive players, and yet two of those spots presumably are spoken for with Christian Yelich in left field and Hunter Renfroe in right. You know, Hunter Renfroe might be traded again. The poor guy has been on, like, what, five teams in 5 years? He's a productive player everywhere he goes, and he had kind of a rough year in 2020 with the Rays, but homered in the World Series, and, like, he's a good player, and he is. Again, I think you can argue the team's best offensive player this year, and it's just an interesting puzzle. You mentioned Kesson Hira. You know, he had the walk-off homer again today, or I should say today, on Monday, early in the week. He's had a really interesting year. We've talked about that. Swing and misses rate is through the roof, but he does produce as well as any offensive player. Is there any way you think he does come back? I just, with the lack of defensive spot for him, and seeming the hesitance that this organization had to even putting him in a position where he can contribute this much offensively tells me that they are not particularly high on him, at least relative to the other options they have now. Do you think there is a chance he comes back?
I think so. I mean, yeah, I would assume he's back.
And to be clear, sorry, like, the Brewers would have to trade him. Like, it's not like he's going to go anywhere by, you know, he's still under control. He's still affordable. Sorry about that.
I would have a tough time. I mean, Hunter Renfroe is one thing. I do think I could see them trading him with 1 year left, on team control and kind of coming off a really good year, maybe getting the most for that with all these prospects coming up. But I would have a tough time seeing them trading away the guy who was their best hitter this year in a year where their offense was not good. And I know there's definitely some concerns about the sustainability of it with, you know, just because of the strikeout rate. And maybe you don't want to commit to him as the DH fully and with no one else in the picture. But also, I mean, I think you hope they learned a lesson from this year and deciding to just, you know, sign a 35-year-old guy to just play DH, who really hasn't been more than a league average hitter for the last, what, 3-4 years now. And so they kind of tied their hands a bit in that spot. McCutcheon's been fine, but certainly not what you want out of a guy who's, you know, DHing day in and day out. Yet it's been in line with his historical production. So I think maybe the idea is to throw a bunch of options at the DH spot, and Hira could certainly be one of those. I just don't know if you want to make your one offseason signing a guy who can just DH and is not necessarily a spectacular hitter at that.
Yeah, and this is what happened to the Brewers, and I've touched on this a little bit. I think we're going to look back and find that Andrew McCutcheon signing was pretty damaging. And not because McCutcheon is a phenomenal person, leader. he's not a bad baseball player. Like he's fine. He is obviously in the not twilight, but he's in the last years of his career. He's a veteran, former MVP. It made sense to want to add him. Where it didn't make sense is boxing this team into having Andrew McCutchen be the primary DH. It took away a lot of their flexibility. And maybe they didn't think Keston Hiura would rise to the level where they needed his bat in the lineup so badly that they would, you know, it would be better to have a DH available for that. Or they didn't realize Christian Yelich's defensive ability would drop to the point that he became a bit of a liability in left field, and it'd be nice to have the DH for him. You know, with Rowdy Tellez out there as well, you could certainly see him be DH a little bit, especially if you're trying to get Hiura onto the field, where first base is kind of, I guess the spot he's got to be. You know, McCutchen, since the calendar turned to August, is batting 196. He's got a 636 OPS. He has not been, he's been hot at times this year, but he, overall, just not the player that I'm sure they were hoping they would get offensively when they signed him to the deal. Not atrocious, not like a slam dunk terrible signing. I just don't like the flexibility that it costs the Brewers for somebody who hasn't been able to replicate, you know, especially against left-handed batters or left-handed pitchers, hasn't been able to be a difference maker. And the Brewers treat him like a difference maker. They put him in the middle of the lineup. They bat him clean up a lot this year. We just haven't seen it. And I wonder, looking back, if there was a chance they could have dedicated those resources to someone else, if that would have really put them in a better position to start the year. I don't know. I've talked about this before a little bit, but am I off base? Like, am I pointing the laser pointer at the wrong thing here, or does that track with you as well?
It's one of many things to point the laser at, I think. They certainly expected more out of him against left-handed pitching. He hasn't quite given them, you know, what his career numbers are. He's hit lefties really well and just hasn't done that this year, aside from that recent game against Andrew Haney. And the Brewers even admitted that they you know, stretched the budget from what they were, you know, normally comfortable doing on Andrew McCutchen, which kind of leads to the question of, you realize he has like been a league average hitter the last 3 years, right? That's not the guy that's going to significantly elevate your offense. But yeah, that's certainly been one of the, I don't think it's one of the biggest issues that's facing this team. But certainly adding, you know, putting a guy hitting cleanup pretty much all year with just that much power, kind of a league average hitter, and at a spot where you need offense from it, DH has been a detriment. And it's also cost that, you know, who knows what Keston Hiura would do with more playing time. But until very recently, it was every day Andrew McCutchen, and there was no budging from that. And I think that's starting to break a little bit, but that was pretty much been the thinking for 5 months.
Christian Yelich came back to earth and then also sustained a neck injury. We didn't see a lot of him in Arizona, so we mentioned it. I was talking about how excited I was to see Yelich absolutely dominate over a weekend like he did last weekend, and then it's sort of back to earth, and this injury issue pops up. He hasn't really missed that many games this year, so this is kind of new, but it doesn't sound like it's super serious. I guess I would expect to see him in Colorado. And then one other thing I wanted to touch on was Esteury Ruiz is called up to the big league team. He's part of the September expansion. It was two roster spots this year, so we saw Luis Perdomo and Ruiz added. Ruiz, of course, came over in the Josh Hader trade. Gotta mention the Josh Hader trade, of course, once per episode, if not more. And he got a lot of playing time. I haven't seen much of him. Offensively, I don't think he's a finished product, so maybe that's just something to note. We haven't even really seen him to get a chance to flash his wheels, his considerable speed. He was on second base when Tyrone Taylor homered in extras on Saturday, so didn't even he was in a position to show some speed. It didn't come up. Were you surprised that it was Ruiz, in fact, who was that position player that they ended up adding when the rosters expanded?
Considering that Mike Brasso sent on rehab assignment, no. From talking to him before the homestand ended, he was hoping to be back for the Bumgarner start. So I did not figure they would call up, you know, thinking they would only need someone for 2 days before Brasso is back. Figured it would not be Ruiz for those 2 days. But considering, you know, what we know now that he's going down for a rehab assignment, not surprised it was Ruiz. He was on the 40-man. Was a bit surprised that he played over Garrett Mitchell on Sunday. It did not matter. Zach Gallen was probably going to dominate them anyway, and giving up five runs on a Zach Gallen start's not going to be a win for you with the way that that man's pitching. But it was a bit surprising to see him, you know, in there against a righty with Garrett Mitchell sitting. So he's an interesting profile. Don't think you'll get the full picture of what he can bring the rest of this year. Who knows how long he's up here with, like I said, Mike Brasso coming back, and how they'll end up moving the roster around. But they've got all these outfielders, and in theory, one or two of them at least will become big league regulars, if not better. And Ruiz certainly has a chance to be one of those guys with the speed pretty much, and kind of the defense that comes with that as the floor. We'll just see if the bat's good enough. I'm not entirely sure it is, but we'll find out.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if Yelich isn't ready. If they do in fact send Ruiz back down, you know, the minor league season is going to be wrapping up here soon, so it's kind of an awkward situation. You know, I don't know what you're supposed to do then. Do you send him home? Like, he's got to be around the team. Maybe he's part of like a taxi squad. I don't know how that quite works now with the rosters limited in their expansion. If some of these guys can linger around a little bit, but that'll be interesting. Okay, let's get into some of the more granular details from the week. It's 3 up, 3 down. Kurt, let's talk promotions. The Milwaukee Brewers reached the 100 millionth fan in franchise history this week.
Oh, baby.
They were very excited about that coming up. They had indicated that they would be celebrating it in a very big way. They offered then $6 tickets for a couple parts of the stadium, the bleacher parts of the stadium, for the remaining weekday, Monday through Thursday is what I mean by weekday, games. There's 10 left on the docket. And they offered then $6 concessions prices to go with that. So they would be loaded right onto your ticket. A lot of people thought that was pretty underwhelming. There was a lot of chatter about it when they announced this early in the week. It felt like maybe didn't quite read the room on how frustrated fans are right now with the Brewers. And so I'm not sure people thought that was really much of a, you know, reward. Those tickets were only available for a 2-day window. You only had 38 hours, I believe, total to order them. So, I'm sure it'll help them sell a few more tickets than normal, but I gotta admit, Kurt, I was scratching my head. It felt like I don't think the offer is bad. It's just, I don't know why they would have hyped it. Maybe they misread how interested people would be in that right now. They have taken some heat for their concession prices. $6 doesn't even get you a bottle of water. So, oh man, Kurt, that was an interesting one. I want to give the Brewers a benefit of the doubt. You know, over the years, I think they've done some really smart things. I really think that they have engaged their fans really well in past years. I'm not seeing it this year necessarily. Obviously, a lot of that is tied to the play on the field, but their attendance is way down. We wrote about that a couple weeks ago, and it has a lot of factors involved. But that ticket promo, Kurt, felt a little bit like, here's something great, right? Looking around the room and everyone's like, that's it. It was an interesting moment in time, Kurt.
It was the perfect storm of bad.
It just happened to be when the team is really flailing, you know, like, yeah, that's really the hard part there.
It was, I mean, objectively, like, at surface level, that's a good offer.
It's, you fine.
Know, $6 tickets. Sure. It's for a weeknight. So that's, you know, during school, after school started. So that's tough. But, you know, $6 tickets, you get $6 on food. That's nice. It's a nice way to, you know, let your fans maybe save some bucks. However, comma, everything that you just listed off, the room was not well read.
No, that was a tough scene. All right, what do you got for 3 up, 3 down?
Garrett Mitchell. On
that's right.
On Monday, was it Monday night?
It was indeed Monday night.
I believe Monday night. The whole week is the whole week kind of ties together at some point. The whole season, actually, it's Groundhog Day.
Yes.
Garrett Mitchell hits his first big league homer, and it ties the game. Bottom of the eighth inning on a game that the Brewers win on Keston Hare's walk off. It was just a really, really cool moment. It was like a 4-day string of cool moments for Garrett Mitchell. Made his debut, made his first start, got a hit, hit a homer. And then, you know, even on Wednesday's game, he came in as a pinch hitter, drew a walk in a key spot as the Brewers tacked on some runs. So that was probably the highlight. You know, even though Keston Hira did hit the walk off, it was Mitchell's homer that was the highlight of the week, really.
What an amazing game Monday was. And it's you know, every game feels like life or death right now with this team, so you lose sight of it pretty quickly. But the Monday, is that not the day where we had the guy on the video board getting friend zoned, or was that earlier? Yeah,
poor Mark.
Yes, Mark got a message from a friend on the video board that went quickly viral, talking about how you know, basically would just rather be friends, don't want to ruin our friendship. And Christian Yelich tweeted about it. It was very funny. This is the same game where Craig Counsell gives the symbol to the bullpen with the Tesla arms to the car.
Not the vulture, the Tesla.
Right. I thought it was a Raptor thing. I mean, it was a weird Raptor thing, so I admit to being a little confused.
Yeah,
but
I thought it was vulture. That's because that's kind of like what a vulture does. But
Brent Suter wears so many hats. He has so many different so many different names. So Craig Counsell went viral for that a little bit. That was very funny. And then just incredible series of home runs in that game. Garrett Mitchell's first career home run ties the game, like you said. Then there's the walk-off. Keston Hiura walks it off. How great is that? O'Neill Cruz for the Pirates hits a home run that is like I don't even know what you call that. Laser beam would be absolutely unfair to how ridiculous the ball was when it was departed from this mortal coil and into the facade of the right field bleachers. So some crazy stuff in that game. Monday night was great time, and then the rest of the week unfolded. Tuesday was a frustrating loss against the Pirates, and it just went from there. But yes, that was a really good game. My next thing. There isn't a whole lot to choose from here. I'm not gonna lie to you.
Yeah, you just listed it all off, but you didn't put any of it on the 3-of-3 down.
All right. Well, let me. If you've got another one, we'll say that's my number two. Just talking about the other aspects of that game. You got another one?
Is it cheating to go off of one thing you said there? You mentioned O'Neill Cruz, but we got to talk about O'Neill Cruz, man.
He is amazing.
He against the Brewers.
Only the Brewers. I mean, well, he did make a big error in a game too.
That's true. This is true. His error was pretty big in that Wednesday game. In terms of his tools, he's a freak. He throws the ball harder than anyone. He runs faster than most anyone, and he hits the ball harder than anyone. It's yet, you know, look at the season numbers, and he's, you know, came in as one of the top prospects in baseball, and it's been a bit of a rough slide for him. Some of the power's there, but most of that power is against the Brewers. His OPS is well over 1,000 against the Brewers, and at last check, it was like 530 something against the rest of the league. I'm not sure how he did this weekend. I think it was pretty good. He had a couple homers against the Blue Jays. So maybe he's turning it around, but you file him under the guys that just mash. They just dominate the Brewers. He is going to be a thorn in the side, methinks, for many years to come.
Yeah, he's going to be a huge problem. He is an adventure right now because he will give you some good and give you some bad, but he's as exciting a Pirate as I can remember. Like, I don't remember them having someone quite at that level of electricity. So that's going to be something they have to deal with. I'll close it down by talking, you know, I gave credit to Gavin Lux when he homered against the Brewers, the Kenosha kid. So we'll highlight another begrudgingly this time, cuz this isn't as fun. You're supposed to lose a couple games to the Dodgers. You're not supposed to lose 3 or 4 to Arizona, but Dalton Varsho, Marshfield native. He is the only player in UW-Milwaukee's history to make it to the major leagues. He had a couple home runs in this series, including one on Sunday, one on Saturday. Really an interesting, like, left field, or I should say right field catcher combination. I don't know how much catching he's done lately, but reminds me, like, Charlie Moore back in 1982 on that Brewers World Series team. He also is a catcher slash outfielder, and so he Dalton Varsho made a great catch on Sunday as well to take away hit an RBI possibly from Tyrone Taylor. So good. It's always good to see Scotties do well. It would be preferable if they do well against other teams. Arizona's going to have some shots at San Diego here going forward, so that's maybe he can continue that. But did want to mention the Scotty. It's part of the brand, and he had a nice series against the Brewers.
That is indeed your brand. I miss when you would do the connection to all 68 teams in the NCAA tournament. Good day.
Yes, that was fun. It ended up being a lot of work for probably not a lot of payoff, but it was a good time. Yes. All right. You want to close it down?
Let's cap things off. This was a week of baseball.
Thank you, Chris.
He says as he tries to come up with another thing that we haven't talked about.
You don't have a clue. I can throw a few at you.
I got something for you.
Okay.
Something seems funky with, you know, the Freddy Peralta dealings, essentially. I mean, you know, there was some alarm bells when he came out of the no-hitter with 82 pitches, and then didn't even make 80 pitches in his last start in which he was pitching pretty, you know, at least decently, five innings and one run. And now he's bumped back in the rotation to give him some more rest for Adrian Hauser to start on Monday in Colorado. And it's, you know, we've asked around plenty and they just say they're, you know, being cautious with them, giving him some more rest. But it makes you wonder what exactly is going on, if there's a bigger issue there. The Brewers have said there's not. I asked if there was anything that, you know, because he threw 90 plus pitches in two straight outings right before the no hitter that wasn't. And so I asked if there was anything, you know, that popped up in those 90 plus pitch outings that, you know, was alarming or they took note of that, you know, okay, we need to be more cautious. And the answer was no. So I don't know the answer because the answers were being given is that everything's fine and they're just being cautious, but there's some concern there, right?
Yeah, I think so. And velocity, I think, has been a little up and down. And, you know, this isn't like two or three starts out of the injury at this point. This is, you know, a month back and we're still seeing him limited to some degree coming out of starts probably a little bit earlier than you'd expect. So I think it's just all tied into the starting pitching just isn't for what, no matter the reason, injury, ineffectiveness, whatever, it's just not as good as it needs to be to truly, truly separate itself. And that's just another aspect to it. And maybe that's a little bad luck that he came down, you know, that he did sustain this injury. I think the Brewers for the most part have been really lucky with injuries among their top starting pitchers. So, you know, like it's not going to be like this forever where they are healthy. So it's, maybe they're being cautious on that front. I don't know, but yeah, something's weird there. A couple more shout outs before we move on. Brent Suter did get touched up on Sunday, but he's been awesome. Actually, he's had a really good second half of the season. And, I tell you what, there's a guy that I thought the Brewers would have moved on from at some point. And, he's just continued to be effective. So props to him. He continues to, he's a great dude as we've talked about before. And he is now, continuing to be a pretty effective pitcher, despite not having the arsenal that you would think of as a frontline pitcher. So he's been valuable. We did have a Zach Davies, Eric Lauer matchup on Friday. Those two were traded for each other somewhat famously, a couple years ago before the 2020 season. Head to head this time, it goes to Davies, which is kind of more on the offense, and it is on Lauer, who pitched very well and has been pretty good, I would say, in the second half. Eric Lauer's been pretty reliable. He's not at the Cy Young level that he was to start the season, but that was a really good start for him, and he continues to look good. Also, a couple good diving catches. Andrew McCutchen had a good one on Tuesday. He's still looking like an outfielder to me, capable of playing the outfield. I'm sure that's not his or the team's choice, but he looks good when he's out there. And Christian Yelich had a nice one on Thursday in Arizona before he left the game with an injury. All right, let's go back in time a little bit. It is our little history segment each week. Remember when? All right, I don't have like a specific thing. First of all, let me just say, last week I had a complete meltdown of brain meltdown here. I said something completely wrong about it was looking back at a moment in 1979 when Brewers had several position players pitch, three position players. I said the ninth inning was Marty Patton. Marty Patton did pitch for the Brewers in the early 1970s, and Marty Patton did in fact pitch the ninth inning of that game. He pitched it for the Royals against the Brewers and was not in fact a pitcher following up three position players and giving up a couple runs. He did give up a couple runs. He gave them up to the Brewers, because by then he had not been a Brewer for several seasons, and was with the Kansas City Royals. Not sure what I was seeing there. That was my notes got tangled up, confusion, stupidity, all of that plays a role here. So sorry about that last time. And this time, like I said, not a specific moment, but I just like looking at this team, and I've said it before, as possibly the most disappointing in Brewers history if they don't make the playoffs, with the expectations that were on this team coming in. Again, that's not entirely the team's fault, but 95 wins, a lot of the same guys back, division worse, more playoff spots available. The fact that they are fighting tooth and nail for everything they have, truly disappointing. And I was trying to imagine what that might match up with. The 1983 team had a lot of people back, with the exception of Pete Vukovich and Raleigh Fingers, who were both injured. So they came back in 1983 thinking they had a pretty good team, and they were in first place for a lot of the year and then really struggled in September. The 2008 team, as many people remember, that team that broke the 26-year drought of playoff appearances, they also had a terrible September. We think of Craig Tember as off now to a rough start. 2008 team did not have Craig Tember. They were three or four games up going into the month, and they absolutely torpedoed into the start of September. Everyone remembers that dreadful series in Philadelphia. They end up firing Ned Yost with only basically half a month of baseball left. They went into that month, I believe, up four games for what would have been the wild card spot. That's after that August 31st game where CeCe Sabathia threw a no-hitter to everyone except the Pirates' official scorer. They end up going down 2.5 games, which is where they are at right now, out of a playoff spot. 2.5 games with just the Sunday and then the final week of the season to go. So I think, what is that? That's six games, I believe? Seven games left. And they were able to pull it off thanks to some last-second dramatics. And then 2014, Kurt, is an interesting one. I wonder what you remember about the 2014 team, because this is a team that was very good out of the gate, absolutely looked like a playoff team for most of the season. They were in first place. They were in first place right up until the end of August. They finally fall back into a tie. They lose the last five games of August, and then the first four games of September, and then four more after that. They go into an absolute tank, and then just can't get it back. I always thought of that 2018 team as, or 2014 team as flawed. Like, I was surprised that they were holding on for as long as they did, but they went into the last, you know, month and a week very much in control, and it just fell apart. Do I misremember that? Did you remember thinking the 2014 team was locked in? That's definitely going to be a playoff team, or do you remember it as kind of a deeply flawed team that was just sort of waiting for that shoe to drop?
Yeah, it seemed like it was all kind of, you know, a mirage. But I do remember there was a series in August, I believe, mid August, where they went into LA and beat the Dodgers in 2 of 3 or 3 of 4.
No, swept them.
They swept them. And that was when it kind of clicked in my mind that, like, oh, this might, like, they, you know, they only got like 6 weeks left. They might be good.
Yeah. And that Dodgers team won 94 games. No slouch. Yes. No slouch.
And that very quickly reversed in my mind. What I remember most is the Rene Rivera game, where kind of began the downslide in San Diego, an extra inning walk-off homer loss to, you know, a relatively anonymous catcher, Rene Rivera. There were some bad calls, I believe, by the home plate umpire. Ron Renicki went ballistic post-game on the umpires. So it was those are honestly the two things that stand out most from the 2014 season to me. I mean, there was a variety of, like, fun moments, you know, for them leading up to that. And then it was, I mean, they were out of it. They were out of it with, what, like 2.5-3 weeks left? It was hard and fast.
It was stunning. At the end, or I should say the middle of August, they're up three games. Sunday, August 17th afterwards, they're up three games in first place. Like I said, they're tied by August 31st. By the end of the season, they are eight games out of first place, and they are barely above 500. They're 82-80. They needed to win in the penultimate game of the season just to guarantee that they were going to finish above 500. Just a staggering, horrible close to the season. And that's not what this Brewers team is facing. This Brewers team has been pretty substandard since the end of May. So that's not really what they're looking at here. This isn't quite, I don't think, the collapse, the August collapse. It looks bad on paper because the St. Louis Cardinals absolutely are never going to lose again. They refuse to lose a game. The Brewers are, I think, just treading water, as they've done for some time. But yeah, that 2014 team, man, that is a precipitous decline. I had forgotten a lot of it. I think everybody remembers Rene Rivera, or at least the people who follow the Brewers closely remember Rene Rivera's contribution there, that series in San Diego. But really, then they go to San Francisco and lose all three of those games after the Rene Rivera game. And then they lose all three in Chicago. You know, like, it was just they just stacked a bunch of losses in a row and just could not get out of a rut. Barely above 500 that year after they were so far up in the NL Central. Okay, let's close this down, Kurt. It's time for Kurt Blanch and your take of the week. Let's go.
Ryan Braun sends it for a center and deep. Get out of here. Gone for Ryan Braun. He just hit a walk-off
of it. Well, we'll just continue the bright, sunny, rainbow optimism that has stemmed from this episode.
This is not our cheeriest episode, we have to admit. No, not our cheeriest episode.
I feel like for 3 months, you know, there have been some moments where you've correctly been wondering if, you know, what the heck this team actually is. And I guess in hindsight, you know, we were spot on with a lot of those things. But for 3 months, it's been kind of trying to, you know, buoy things and say, oh, they're close and, you know, they're still in it and yada yada, a lot of time left. But the reality is they're 2.5 back with a month to go and have not shown a ton of signs of being able to snap that around. Now they might. But if they don't and they fail to make the playoffs this year, again, if this happens, you kind of mentioned this in your Remember One, is I think this would have to be looked at as the season that underwhelmed in terms of expectations. The season in which the gulf between their expectations and their performance was the widest in a bad way. I mean, they've just underperformed what was expected to a significant degree. I mean, it might end up only being, what, you know, the 10 wins underperforming if you go 85 and 77 or whatnot. But to miss the playoffs outright, in which there's, you know, six teams make it, three wild cards, and three teams in your division simply aren't trying. And that's looking at the glass half full version of what those teams are doing this year. It would be bad. It would not be good. You look at, you know, some of the guys that they entered, that were on the roster entering the year: Corbin Burns, Brandon Woodruff, Josh Hader, Christian Yelich, Devin Williams, Willie Adames. You know, all these guys. You've got a good roster, but everything that happened would have to be seen as a significant disappointment. You could probably, you know, I'm not really big into, you know, whether it's, you classify things as, you know, a failure or not in that sort of dichotomous view, but it would certainly, you'd have to consider it, if not a failure, as close to one, if you just can't make the playoffs and right this ship at all, because, you know, you think about it, and also you got off to the hottest 50-game start in franchise history with 32-18, and since then have had countless chances to, you know, turn the tide, thought they did it coming out of the All-Star break, but that wasn't the case. And I don't know what more to add than that, but it's been bad.
Yeah, when we talk about disappointing seasons, 2014, that was a pretty good one, only because they were in such good shape for most of the year. But still, I don't think that team was expected to do what they did, given who they had on that roster. In 1983, sure, it was disappointing. They also only had two playoff teams or four playoff teams in the AL. So they're not going to, that's still two playoff teams. So, that's a really hard, you know, lineup to crack. Six teams are making it from the National League. And not only that, but like, there's only seven teams that are above 500 still. The Brewers are going to be that seventh team at this rate. And that's just really remarkable. Like, I still can't wrap my head around it. I still think that any day we're going to wake up and the Brewers are going to start going on a six run, you know, they're going to win the next six games, because I mean, this team has supposed to have the pitching, supposed to have at least enough offense to get through. And those guys are there. They're not hurt. And I just wonder what comes next. Like, as I said earlier, what are you excited about going into 2023 outside of maybe a couple of the kids filtering up? You know, you're also not going to expect them to be like difference makers right out of the bat. They're not Jackson Churio level prospects. So at some point you wonder, is this team going to continue sliding backwards into 2023? And then what do you have? So this is a tough spot for sure. Not a great time, but we keep saying it, there's still that glimmer of hope. Mathematically, this thing ain't over, and you just have to ride it out. Unfortunately, if you're someone looking for closure, you're not gonna get it. Not for a couple weeks yet. But you know, the Brewers are gonna be playing the majority of what's left at home. They start the week on the road at Coors Field, not necessarily a place you want to write the ship. But you know, we'll see how that goes. All right, Kurt, we got. Yeah, that was a tough one.
There's a lot there.
Yeah, we'll be cheerier next week. Actually, that's not. I can't. Yeah,
you can't.
That.
You can't. You can't say. You can't guarantee that from yourself.
I absolutely cannot.
That's a bad thing to do.
We'll be back with you next week. Now, I'm going to move into my interview with Jason Gerwin. Again, he is from thestreamable.com. He covers streaming machinations all over the internet slash TV landscape, and wanted to ask him about Bally Sports Wisconsin. And we talked about this the situation where people are struggling to find the Brewers. Cord cutters are not able to get the Brewers on their TVs. So I wanted to ask him about if the Sinclair, who owns Bally Sports Wisconsin, what their situation is. I know there's been some talk of their financial struggles. Like, will things change for Brewers fans and kind of some of the factors at play? Not necessarily any good news, but I wanted to get him in here because he has a lot of knowledge and a lot of interesting stuff to say. So here is that. Thanks for tuning in this week. We'll chat with you again soon. Bye-bye. My guest is Jason Gerwin of The Streamable. It's a website. If you've never been to it, you could check it out. It has a ton of information on streaming from pretty much any of your favorite TV shows, streaming services, and for our purposes, a little bit of streaming sports. The Brewers, of course, as many people know, not as available as they used to be. For anyone who has cut the cord, Bally Sports Wisconsin airing pretty much exclusively on cable and on satellite. And as we did a story this past week on the attendance and how it's dropped, a lot of people citing the fact that they're disconnected from the team because they can't watch the team as often as they used to. So I wanted to get Jason on to talk about the streaming picture as it relates to Bally Sports, to its parent company, Sinclair, what the future might hold, if some of these people are going to get access to the Brewers on TV again at any time in the near future. And I want to start my understanding of Sinclair, which again is the company that sort of owns and operates Bally Sports Wisconsin, is that it has not gone well for them since they've acquired the regional sports networks. We'll call them RSNs going forward. It seems like that company is in a little bit of dire straits, but I don't know if that necessarily means anything for the average Brewers fan or anything. So can you just give me a sense of Sinclair and this operation and what the prognosis is for it?
Yeah, so I guess like the big picture is, you know, when they bought the RSNs a couple years ago, it had pretty wide distribution across cable, satellite, and live TV streaming services like YouTube TV and Hulu and even Sling. And over the course of that period, all but DirecTV Stream have dropped them. So, you know, because of that, it became largely inaccessible. And because of it being dropped by all these services, they decided they wanted to launch a DTC service. So, you know, in Wisconsin, it's already soft launched as Bally Sports Plus. And, you know, that's kind of their model that they need to work with for cord cutters going forward.
Yeah, that DTC, direct-to-consumer, it works out good for people in Milwaukee who want to watch the Brewers. They have that other option now. They pay a fee and they can have this service month to month. But I know the technology is there's a lot of complaints about it, and it sounds like it's still maybe, I don't know, fledgling, getting off the ground. I don't know if this is sort of what the final product is going to look like. Do you know offhand what, and maybe there are other places doing something similar, but specifically, is it going to get better? Like, are they going to expand it, or like what can people expect changes, if anything?
Yeah, so right now the product is identical to what cable subscribers had as the Bally Sports app, where you could log in with your TV Everywhere credentials and access it. The only difference is you can now sign up for it directly. From a usability and a functionality and a stability standpoint, it definitely needs some work. I think they know that. And I don't think it's going to change very much in the next couple months, but, you know, they've always said that this is the starting point and they expect it to evolve over the next 12 months to have more functionality, whether it's, you know, in-game stats and the ability to do in-game betting, even if it's not theoretically legal, like free betting, in certain markets. And just make it a better product. So it's certainly a starting point. I would say, like, for people that are used to streaming on things like YouTube TV, or even something like MLB TV, Bally Sports app and Bally Sports Plus just isn't there yet, but it is an option, which I think everyone has been asking for a really long time.
Last time we talked, you discussed what the Brewers or any team could have done differently rather than go with what was then Fox Sports Wisconsin became Bally Sports, and that there weren't a lot of options, that the times that teams have tried to sort of circumvent, you know, kind of have their own in-house broadcast situation, it hasn't worked out. It's gone very poorly. given that we've had now a couple years of this, and now the Brewers are seeing, like I said, a decline in attendance, which may or may not be related. There are many factors in play, but could teams like the Brewers get more aggressive about circumventing that current model when that contract comes up again? Is it possible they could look to doing something a little bit more outside the box, a little more unconventional, to make sure that this gets into more homes, or at least give it a shot to get it into more homes?
I don't think the teams have any incentive to do that, despite what they will tell the fans that they want to make this more accessible. There is no model that is better for them than the existing RSN model, right? When you look at how RSNs, you know, get paid, every cable subscriber, whether they watch it or not, gives a fee every single month throughout the season if the team is good, if the team is bad, when the team is playing, when the team is not playing. And that allows for these massive rights deals for even teams that are in smaller markets. If the Brewers then said, hey, we're going to launch our own direct-to-consumer service, we're not going to sell our rights, they'd make a fraction of what they're getting paid by Sinclair. And that's the problem with the model. It's, you know, the teams need to make it work. Sinclair needs to make it work. MLB needs to figure out how to make it work. You know, baseball is such a local game versus the NFL, which is all about, you know, big national broadcasts, that, you know, right now they're walking a very delicate line, because they're trying to have the existing model work where RSNs are in cable and they have this great lucrative way to make money from it, but also give an option to fans where if they want to get a DTC, price it high enough that the cable companies don't drop them, but not so low that there will be complaints as well. So it's a really hard balance, and I don't think this is going to end up well for the teams or Sinclair.
And you brought up something else the last time we chatted that definitely caught my attention, that this strategy that Bally's has employed of having this their own app is a little counterintuitive, because it undercuts what they can charge from distributors like cable and satellite, because there are theoretically people now who have walked away from cable and satellite because they only care about the sports, the local sports, and they're now going to get the app. Have you witnessed any consequences to them doing this? I know it's still kind of in the soft launch. I'm actually not clear if we're past the soft launch phase or not, because Milwaukee, you know, has full access, so I haven't really thought about it beyond that. But have there been any issues then maintaining, you know, RSNs on more traditional places because they now have their own app?
So I think the reason why they were so willing to be aggressive to run this launch is their next major rights deal doesn't expire until the end of next year with DirecTV. They recently signed a new deal with Comcast. They signed a new deal with Charter. So like a lot of the big deals are out of the way. And I assume as part of those agreements, they're like, hey, this is coming, right? And to be honest, I'm not sure the cable companies, if this is priced where it is, where it's $20 a month, they really care. Like one thing that a lot of people don't know about this, you're not actually subscribing to a team. You're not subscribing to Bally Sports Plus for the Brewers. You're actually subscribing to Bally Sports Wisconsin. So like in certain markets, it's actually more expensive than $20. Like down in Florida where I am, if I sign up for Comcast, I'll get Bally Sports Florida and Bally Sports Sun, which would give me one channel, the Panthers and the Marlins and the Magic, and on another channel, the Heat and the Lightning, right? So to get all those teams, just like I would with my cable package, I actually need two separate Bally Sports Plus subscriptions. So it would cost $40 in order to do that. They are working on ways to offer discounted bundles, but I'm not sure how low that can go. And Florida is not the only market that that's an issue in. This is going to be happening in Los Angeles, where they have some teams on Fox, on Bally Sports West, and some on Bally Sports SoCal. This is going to happen in other parts of the country, where some are on Bally Sports Southeast and some are on Bally Sports South. So, you know, this isn't a very simple transition at all for anyone.
Right. You know, something else too, that again, that we've discussed before that caught my attention, is we talked about the option of making it a tile, like in Amazon or Disney. You know, there's often layered services within the broader service, and how that wouldn't work here, because again, that would sort of undercut some of the other sort of contractual agreements they have. And then you sort of put the idea in my head that at some point, even cable companies that have it now, even Spectrum in Milwaukee or DirecTV will offer this as a premium service. Like, sure, you can get Bally Sports Wisconsin, but only for that premium upcharge. That places like Dish and Sling TV would love to do that now, but that's not what they want to do. That's not what Bally wants to do, what Sinclair wants to do. But at some point, we could get there. Do you feel like that's still the progress, that at some point, everybody's going to be paying extra to get these channels?
I mean, people are already paying extra to get the channel. It's just hidden, right? Like in your regional sports fee.
Exactly.
Sinclair can't let that happen, though. Like the problem, if that happens with a Comcast, that means that many fewer people are paying them for that channel. So like instead of it adding $5 to 100% of people's bill, it would have to add $30 to 10% of people's bills, right? To the people mm-hmm. who are actually paying. And even then, you're earning significantly less. The numbers just never work out if the model breaks where it becomes an add-on. Like the one reason why DirecTV is this, you know, interesting company in terms of their relationship with Sinclair is they're one of the few services that actually tier the channel. So on most cable operators, if you have any cable plan, you're getting the RSN, right? On DirecTV, you actually have to upgrade not from their base tier to their middle tier on both their streaming service and on their satellite package, which means that there's a fewer percentage of their subscribers that are actually paying for it. So they care less about it being involved in the plant.
I'm curious how this looks in 5 years. And I know that it changes so often that that's a pretty, pretty long-term prognosis. Streaming is becoming a bigger part of this with Apple and Peacock and I don't think Paramount's involved yet, actually, but who knows? Anytime in the future, there's lots of different games going to different places. And I think it seems unlikely that the linear model disappears altogether anytime soon, but there's so much more of the streaming component. In 5 years, is it just going to be premium? Is Sinclair going to exist? Like, I'm really curious to know what you think happens next.
I mean, as someone who runs a streaming site, like I can tell you how many people have been are confused where sports is available to stream, like with games, you know, Thursday night football games on Amazon and Sunday morning baseball games on Peacock and Friday night games on Apple TV Plus. I think a lot of people are going to be wishing the cable bundle is back, right? You turn yeah. on your TV and you have an option to watch anything. 5 years from now is a long time in the world of this. If you look 5 years back at Netflix, it's a very different company than it is today. So I imagine 5 years from now, the landscape is going to be very different. The one thing that we do know, a lot of these rights deals are locked up longer term, right? Mm-hmm. Especially the national TV deals. I think the one open question is, does Sinclair's Diamond Sports Group that owns the Bally Sports RSN survive 5 years? They have about $8 billion in debt. Their cash that they're throwing off every year is declining. I think it's about $200 million that they're making now, which obviously isn't enough to cover $8 billion in debt. So, you know, there's been reports that they're looking to restructure that debt. So I think that is going to be the big deciding factor. I think, you know, before Sinclair bought the RSNs, Major League Baseball was reportedly interested in buying them, but they just weren't willing to pay anywhere near what Sinclair was. I think Major League Baseball would love to have all the local rights that they could either package and resell to someone else or add it to MLB TV. But the hard thing with that is, you know, unlike football, where every national team is TV's rights are kind of worth the same, in Major League Baseball, it's so different, right? Like the Yankees local TV deal versus the Brewers local TV deal is so different. So how would you even divvy that up if Major League Baseball, you know, owned these rights? But I would say it definitely will be more accessible. It has to be, right? Like the world where we lived the last 2 years, where if you wanted to stream it, you either had to do it illegally or sign up for DirecTV Stream. It's not going to work. So, you know, if I was going to bet on something like this, I would say that, you know, I think it is unlikely that Bally Sports in its current form will exist in 5 years. But I think there is an opportunity for it to evolve, whether they share the rights with MLB TV or you can sign up for Bally Sports Plus via MLB TV and they just have a rev share on it. I think they just need to have more touch points where people can actually get it. Otherwise, you know, the other option people have is to get it illegally, which I think a lot of people do or not watch at all.
Yeah. What if MLB took over just this small component that's run by Bally's? We're not talking about major markets. We're talking about, I think it's the Royals, the Tigers, you know, the Brewers, Tampa Bay, I believe. I mean, that'd be a small piece of the puzzle. The Yankees would still be their separate thing. The Dodgers would still be their separate thing. But I don't know, that gets into, I guess, like the philosophy of sport. If the Brewers or if MLB would be willing to just take on part of it, and then suddenly you can watch it on your MLB TV app in Milwaukee. I don't think that's going to happen personally, but I don't know. Is that possible? Is that, you know, like, do a piecemeal approach?
I mean, it's certainly possible. Again, the economics just don't work out in that way, right? Like, if MLB takes it over and offer from MLB TV, like the problem, which I think a lot of people who look at it from the outside don't understand, is this can't be cheap. This can't be Disney Plus at $7.99 and charge $50 million a year for local TV rights. You just can't get it down to that price. And I hear people online all the time being like, $19.99 a month is too expensive, or $189 a year is, which relative to a lot of other services, it is. And I'm not saying that's cheap at all, but that's kind of the price that it has to be to exist in the current ecosystem. The only way that price goes down is if the cable part of it completely goes away and there's no fear at all about losing those subscribers.
All right, he's Jason Gerwin from The Streamable website, again, covering streaming. You know, I tried to give you that lame plug. Why don't you tell me, like, why people, you know, why they should check out your website and what sort of services you offer there?
Yeah, so I think what people will love about The Streamable is we try to make streaming simple. I think sports and streaming sports have gotten more confusing than ever. There's a million different ways that you can watch either individual games or follow your team. And we just give you the answer where you can watch your team or watch your game. So, you know, instead of going and trying to find it on Google, you can come to us and we'll just give you the answer.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. You've been very, very helpful to me over the years here. So trying to explain some of these issues. Thank you so much, sir. We'll talk to you again very soon, I'm sure.
It was great to be here.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.